Good morning, everybody. Welcome to another edition of News You Can Use. I hope you're having and off to a good morning so far. And I'm very excited to introduce our guest today. We're going to talk about some very interesting topics. Donna Gore, who's also known as Lady Justice, Leader for Change, is our guest on this program today. And we've got some very interesting topics to discuss with you. Donna, we go way back. I can't even remember how you and I met when you were here in Connecticut.
Well, we do. In fact, Dan, I looked up when you were on my show when I first started. You were on my show talking, known as Media Maven. That's what Delilah just described you. We talked about crime and media's interaction with crime victims way back in 6 of 2012. Yeah, that's a lifetime ago. But we actually met because you came to an event that I sponsored. I worked for 21 years for the State of Connecticut Services for the Blind, which is now known under a different name of Aging and Disability Services. And I, for many years, they had an award show at the Legislative Office Building. And a couple of years, I was in charge of it, and I had Dr. Bill Pettit, fortunately, agreed to be an MC for that, and you attended that function, and I believe that's when we first met.
Wow, it's been a long time. Well, it's great to talk to you again. A lot has changed since then. You've relocated from Connecticut to South Carolina, but I want to get into, because we have so many things to talk about. I want to start with your story, Donna, because you really are a victim of violence yourself. I mean, that's unfortunately something that you deal with in your life. So why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about what happened to you and what happened to your father?
Okay. Well, the violence happens to be homicide. My dad was killed in a homicide April 17, 1981, 40 years ago. So, Ann, I have 40 years of experience working with homicide survivors. And that's not something that I had ever thought I would be venturing into. But, you know, violent crime just happens abruptly. And you're thrust into it, changes your family dynamic totally. And here we are 40 years down the road. And so what happened with my dad, in a nutshell, is that it was on a weeknight. He was a master carpenter by trade. Built things his whole life. Worked for acoustical ceilings, but he also had other businesses. He owned bars and restaurants. He also owned an auto hauling business and junk car business. So he was a perpetual workaholic, kind of like I am, and during the evenings, he came home from his auto haul business on the Hartford West Hartford line, and he would go out collecting money for used cars that he might sell people that couldn't afford, you know, fancy cars. And another thing was that he and my grandmother also, for about 20 years, owned property in Hartford, so they were landlords, and so he had his hand in many different things. So he had gone out that evening to go and collect some money for cars or selling cars that he wanted to do. And lo and behold, he had a certain routine, and he didn't return, and my mother became concerned. And she called everyone she could think of. He was a missing person for approximately several hours or a day, which is much less than many of the other missing person families I know, but it was still very disconcerting. So what had happened was that he was approached at one of the businesses that he frequents by a female, I guess that was an acquaintance of his, and her boyfriend turned out to be a career criminal and a drug dealer, etc. And he needed to escape the law. He needed some fast cash. So this woman felt my father carried a big bankroll because of his different businesses that he had going. And in actuality, Ann, he only had $35 on him. So she, this woman was an accomplice to the murder. She approached him. They had an interaction. They happened to be in his van that he drove, and she thought that they were just going to rob him, and that would be that. All of a sudden, the perpetrator comes up by the driver's side window and sticks the gun in his face, and they did rob him, but because he could be identified, he felt that he had to kill him, which supposedly is unbeknownst to the female. So he shot him 5 times and left him to die in his van and all vital organs. And my dad actually tried to drive himself to, I believe, St. Francis Hospital, and he didn't make it. The van rolled into a house, and the motor was running. Some say it was like for 30 minutes or so, but I'm not exactly sure. He was brought to the hospital, and he did not make it. But they said had he made it, he would have been in a vegetative state, you know, and no quality of life, which would not have been his choice or our family's choice.
Wow, what a horrible story, Donna. Is this what kind of got you involved in looking into other missing persons and and murders in Connecticut especially? And we're going to talk about some of those. And I know you've done your homework for the show, so I'll kind of let you lead off with some of your thoughts. I mean, I especially wanted to touch base with the Jennifer Dulos case. I mean, what do you know about that that we don't know?
Well, I have to tell you, it's a very complex case with many, 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 many twists and turns. And, you know, because I'm a writer and because I'm very much a person of intellectual curiosity and analysis, I just happen to notice certain traits that are characteristic in each case. And sometimes I bring them to the fore for discussion. And the Jennifer Dulos case, some of the bare bones of that is that she went missing May 24, 2019, and she was age 50 at the time. She had dropped off her kids at school and never returned. And her husband, you know, her husband owned many properties. He was in real estate. He was a very charismatic person, wheeling and dealing, and, you know, a person of wealth on the outside, but really it was all on paper. He owed tons of money. And when she went missing, like I say, they waited a few days and they could not find her. And the details of the case involve a girlfriend, Michelle Traconis, who I believe she is Spanish is her claim to be her first language, and they he had been having affairs with women, I think, for the last few years, and the marriage wasn't exactly a happy one. So he wanted to kill her because they were undergoing a very contentious divorce, and there were 5 little children, I'd say no older than maybe 8 years old, and there was a fierce custody battle. So another attorney, Mr. Mawani, and Michelle Traconis, were charged with conspiracy, which is an agreement to commit an offense. The Harford police, searched for weeks and weeks and weeks because of the, the Harford landfill, because videotapes had captured him driving around Harford, and supposedly Michelle that she had no idea that he had remains in garbage bags that he was going to be dropping off on Albany Avenue, which I find is very unbelievable.
Well, you know, Donna, you can't be Michelle Chaconis and be riding along, you know, with this guy and not know what he's doing. I mean, I think we all know better than that, right? So let's fast forward a little bit. You know, Doulos then jailed, commits suicide.
Yeah, that comes at the very end.
Right. And then Michelle, so what's going to happen to Michelle Chaconis? What do you think about that?
Well, I tried to look up the status yesterday of what's going on. And I have to tell you, there is a personal connection with me to this case. John Schoenhorn, who is her third attorney, and this has been going on for 2.5 years. He happened to be on with Dennis Hausa, WTNH-TV, recently. And there was a federal grand jury going on with FOTUS, but not with her. And what the connection is that John Schoenhorn was in the beginning stages of his career as a public defender, and he was the second chair in the murder trial with my father and another murderer that was done simultaneously. And this is 40 years later.
Wow.
So here he is defending people. So what I found out was that on September 26th, he was hired as her third attorney after 2.5 years. She is out on bond. She can travel to Colorado or Florida, and he's filed a motion saying that the interrogation that they did with her violated her rights because Spanish was her primary language, and that she really didn't know what he was doing, which to me is a bunch of bull.
Right.
So they are waiting. They are waiting for this to come to trial, I believe.
Yeah. So it's going to be a while. If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Donna Gore, who's also known as Lady Justice, and Donna does her homework. And if you want to check her out, Donna is on all social media, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, and also has some archived radio programs, as we talked about at the beginning of this program, called Shattered Lives Radio. So, you know, we're probably never going to find out where Jennifer Doulos is. I mean, I think
we... The remains.
Yeah.
I wouldn't think so.
So now let's move on. You've got some other high-profile cases that are still out there in Connecticut, unsolved cases. Talk a little bit about that.
Okay. Well, the other one that... This is the Richard and Connie DeBassi case in Ellington, in which on December 23rd, 2015... He had killed his wife in their home. They had two small sons. He killed her while the two little boys were at school, and he was arrested in April of 2017. And in that case, again, he had at least two girlfriends, and one of them he impregnated, and I don't know how else to put it. And he wanted to get rid of her, wanted to do it in such a way as to not cause embarrassment to him. How could you not? So he actually looked up before he killed her, he actually looked up poison that you couldn't detect. And his story was that to the police, a masked man tied him up and shot his wife before he burned him with a torch. And the linchpin in this case, Ann, was that Connie had a Fitbit watch. And this is the first time ever that a Fitbit watch was used, the data was used as primary evidence in this case. It seemed to... He had said that she was killed at such and such an hour, and they determined that Connie's Fitbit watch, that she was still moving around an hour after she was killed. So they, you know, she was caught.
Right. Well, let me ask you a question, though, because I remember this case well. Why do you think it took police so long to arrest him? He was out and about, you know, living his life, staying in his home with his kids for a long time.
Well, I think it's a matter of having probable cause to arrest and having enough evidence to be able to prove the case. Again, this happened, you know, during the holiday season back when. But this has prolonged even up until this time because Hubie Santos, who is a well-known
defense attorney,
he passed away in June. So essentially, my understanding is, and even with COVID, all of the trials and everything has been, you know, during 2020 because of the pandemic, everything was taken off the schedules and whatnot, and they had to start with a whole new jury selection.
Right, start all over. Wow.
Yeah, start all over. So essentially, that's what they're having to do, and you know, in terms of jury selection, most people are like maybe my age and older. They pick people that maybe are retired or happily retired because you just can't get people to sit on a jury because of their job responsibilities. But you got to think of the fact that over 700,000 people have died of COVID of all ages, but a good proportion of them have been the age in which people sit on a jury. So I can't imagine that this is going to be an easy thing. And I'm curious to see whether, you know, some of these jury trials are going to be held, you know, if they're actually going to be done on Zoom, on Facebook, because, you know, that's the only way to control spread of infection and whatnot.
So, yeah, I guess the bottom line is in the case here, the DeBassi case, we're just going to have to wait and see when the system can catch up due to COVID, which
right.
Unfortunately is everybody's excuse for not getting things done. But anyway, all right, let's move on now to not here in Connecticut, but the Gabby Petito case.
This was a very high-profile case because of the fact that she was on, her life was almost a travelogue in terms of documenting every single thing that she did and they did as a couple, particularly on this adventure that they were doing. Had they not done that, then they might not have had the evidence. But I get disillusioned because there are over 600,000 people that go missing every year. And not to say that her case is not important, but many of them are, a majority of them are not publicized because they are the underserved poor. They might be minorities. They don't have the resources. They don't know how to access resources in order to get the exposure, in order to get the help. So this just happened to be the latest one. And I did want to mention, if people want to know what is the primary domestic violence case in Connecticut, and I did a blog several years ago that went virtual and changed the face of domestic violence across the nation with Tracy Thurman. In 1983. So people really should read about that, because had that case not occurred and changed laws in terms of how they arrest people and whatnot, we would not have the laws that we do now had it not been for Tracy Thurman of Torrington. So if people want to look that up on my website and read about it, because I know we're short on time, they should be looking at that, because that started the whole movement, Ann.
So if you're looking for more information, as Donna mentioned, you can go to her website, donnagore.com. That's donnagore.com. You know, and it just came out, we are getting tight on time, but I want to mention, too, that, you know, news just came out today out of Northport, Florida, that they think that one of the biggest mistakes that police made, you know, when we talk about Brian Laundry, who is accused of killing Gabby Petito, is that they mistook the mother driving the Mustang away when it was actually him. But now, you know, that's kind of case closed because his remains have been found. I'm curious to know, as someone who's worked with victims of violence and missing people, Donna, what would your hope had been? You know, he kind of took the easy way out, in my opinion, the cowardly way out. What would you have liked to see happen to this young man should he have been found alive?
Well, I believe that he should have turned himself in, and with the protections of the law, in that, you know, you're innocent until proven guilty, and the support of his family and whatnot. He should. The victims, Gabby's family, really got a raw deal because there will never ever be justice, and he should have been man enough to actually, you know, confess his crimes and deal with it. And I just have to say that young men particularly, you know, they have more immature brains. They're not mature until at least 25 years old. And I don't know exactly how old he was, but it's very typical for men to just be very impulsive. And I just think that it is such a disservice. And I wonder if his family would be charged with, like, aiding and abetting, you know.
Yeah, I think that's next. To answer your question, Brian Laundry was 23 years old, you know, but what a coward. And his family, I don't have a whole lot of respect for either. I think they could have been of more, and you mentioned too, you know, that this was such a high profile, you know, international media case. And I think a lot of that had to do that there were pictures to go with the story, Donna. I mean, she was on social media all the time, beautiful young girl, blonde hair, you know, and you're exactly right. So it was interesting. There were pictures to go with the story. There was, you know, video, police cam video from when they were stopped. And so, you know, I know from working in television that makes for a better story. And it doesn't mean that all the other victims out there don't deserve the same sort of coverage that they don't get. Well, I got to tell you, Donna, this has been an amazing conversation. And I know how hard you work out there in South Carolina at your computer and always, you know, doing what you can for victims of domestic violence, for missing persons. And as someone who's also unfortunately lost, you know, their father to gun violence by a career criminal, which is another whole topic. I could talk to you forever about all these things.
Well,
yeah.
Maybe we can do another one in the future if you so desire. All right. The anniversary of Susan Murphy Milano, visionary and advocate for people who are homicide survivors and domestic violence victims, and Stacey Peterson, they share October 28th as the anniversary together.
Wow.
One for going missing and one for Susan's death.
Wow. Well, Donna Gore, this has been enlightening. I want to thank you for your time. I'm sure the weather in South Carolina is a lot better than it is here, so enjoy that.
Thank you so much, Ann, and we'll stay in touch, okay?
We absolutely will. And again, the website is donnagore.com, donnagore.com. You can also check her out on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to have you tune in to this edition of News You Can Use.